Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, and today is our sixth edition of Clean Water Radio, a Friday series focusing on this resource so vital to all people in our state. My guest later in the hour will be Michael Delaney, a Des Moines water lover and sportsman who has been intensively involved in river cleanup on the Raccoon River, there on the western edge of the Des Moines Lobe. Michael founded the Raccoon River Watershed Association 10 years ago. As a fisherman, he is a longtime member of the Isaac Walton League, and he recently founded Citizens for a Healthy Iowa. He just walked in the door, so we'll be welcoming him in a minute. This week, the big commodity groups in Iowa unveiled an alliance for clean water. We're going to look into that as well. And we've got the rest of my interview with Mary Skopek, who's on the staff of Iowa DNR as the coordinator of the Iowa Water Volunteer Water Quality Monitoring Program. And we spoke with her last week, and we're going to resume that interview today. So Michael is here. Welcome, Michael Delaney.
Good morning, Greta. How are you?
I'm fine. And so we were talking about Mary Skopek. You've worked as a volunteer water monitor, have you not?
Yes, I have. I was trained a long time ago by Rich Leopold, who was DNR director for a while and back in the area working with Polk County. But yeah, that was many years ago, probably 12, 15 years ago.
Well, one of the questions I asked Mary came directly from my correspondence with you and also Danielle Worth of Woodward, Iowa, who's there on the Des Moines River. Both of you were concerned that the data from the Iowa Water Quality Monitoring volunteers had not been available for months, and that was still the case when I talked to Mary last week, but I had to cut that piece out of my interview. Evidently, that water data site is up and running again.
Oh, really? Well, that's news to me. I just was told a few days ago that it was not available. So, good.
Yeah, well, Danielle, according to Danielle, so I couldn't find the link. I thought you might have it. I'll get back to her and put that link on our website.
Well, there is the ambient monitoring data, which is DNR collected data. I believe that's still available. But what the volunteers have collected for a long time was not available, as Mary said, because of a change in the system, I guess.
Yeah, they were moving the data from one physical site to another physical site, and it wasn't, she mentioned it wasn't the highest of priorities there at the DNR, but it got done, evidently.
Good.
Yeah, so you've been monitoring water quality probably for a long time there on the Raccoon River?
Oh, yes. We, a group of us started the Raccoon River Watershed Association about 10 years ago, and many of us were monitoring water prior to the beginning of that association, but then we started doing snapshots on a fairly regular basis in the watershed, up and down the watershed. Snapshot is you go out, a bunch of people go out to different locations, and they take samples, and they do their own tests with their kit, and then we take samples to the Des Moines Water Works, and they do further testing and back up our own data, so it's really credible data, so we can, you know, we're pretty sure what we're talking about.
So you do it all simultaneously. Is that part of the...
Yeah, snapshot is a one-time look at what is in the water. And is, you know, it has limited use as far as trends and all that, but it does help us to know, you know, we know what's in the water at that particular time, up and down, and so we can see over from year to year, we can see changes.
All right. And then last week, I understand you were out picking up trash through Project Aware along the river. Project Aware is a topic we haven't covered on this show, Clean Water Radio. Maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about what Project Aware
is. Yeah. Project Aware is wonderful. It's a DNR project. Mary Skopek is out there in the mud and hauling, you know, bottles and cans and pieces of trash and all that with Lynette Sigley's usually... has always been involved with it, and a whole lot of other DNR folks, and then volunteers. And in probably 6 years ago, Project Aware focused on the Raccoon River. So they started up on the Middle Raccoon or White Rock. We camped at White Rock, and then we started down the Middle Raccoon. There were 400 people involved that particular year. Backup, you know, people sorting, people on, you know, at the boat docks loading trash. And then, hundreds of people in canoes go down the river. And yeah. When we stopped for lunch, you'd have a string of, you know, dozens and dozens of canoes along a sandbar. It was beautiful. And we got, I think on that one, it was like 20 tons of trash out of the middle. And then we jumped over to the North Raccoon and went all the way down to Walnut Woods, where we ran into a storm. So the final day was basically helping Walnut Woods and State Park employees pick up broken limbs and, you know, help sort things out. We really, and the water was high in the river, so we really weren't able to go on down to the boat dock at Waterworks Park, which was our intended, you know, stopping point.
So full-fledged Project Aware project is a multi-day adventure, it sounds like.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Year after year, some families will, you know, take their vacation time and paddle down the river, camping and doing all that service. And it, you know, it's, you have beautiful time on the water, but also you get involved in digging out barrels and tractor tires and just all sorts of stuff. Here's the good news about that I've discovered over 10 years of participating in this kind of thing. Most of the trash in the river is old. It's been there a long time. Iowans have used the rivers as dumps. And you can understand why pioneers would do that. You have all this water coming down and few people, and you could dispose of your waste and, you know, whatever. You throw it in the river. You have plenty of turtles and vultures around and other cleanup stuff that's edible, and then, you know, most of it kind of would just go away because most everything was degradable. You know, wooden stuff and paper stuff and all that. But then as we got into the industrial era, it became, you know, farm equipment and then cars. And it's just, so we still have that. I mean, there still are cars on the banks. There's a bus in the river up above Perry. It's just like, you know, people just saw the rivers as places to dispose of things. And it just kept going. Now, today, the attitude has changed. We have water trails and a lot of paddlers and people that just are disgusted by that. So people come out, and once you've cleaned up a stretch of river, the next time you go back, it's mostly just bottles and cans and styrofoam cups and things like that. The kids leave their, you know, their pop and their beer on sandbars. Fishermen, you know, my pals who fish are notorious for having a campfire, and they'll leave their cigarette butts and their bottles and cans and bubble wrap from their lures and bait containers laying around. But most of the really bad stuff, if a river has been cleaned up a couple of times by Project Aware or some other group, most of the time the big old bad stuff, the tires and so on, are gone.
And, Michael, when I first contacted you a couple weeks ago, you were preparing for the debate of the candidates for the governor at the Iowa State Fair.
Right.
And making water quality a topic of political debate has been a mission of your statewide group, Citizens for Healthy Iowa.
Right.
Are you focusing just on the governor's race or all races across the state?
No. Citizens for Healthy Iowa is a group that is concerned about our health, but also the health of the state. We're concerned about life in the water and life on the landscape. We're concerned about bees and pollinators and everything else. But, of course, we're part of the ecosystem. We consume the water, we breathe the air, and our food is affected by what's on the landscape. So that whole thing, we're interested in the whole ecosystem. But of course, the main concern for people is themselves, their kids, you know. So that's the focus right now, because we do have serious threats to human health in a lot of our water. So that's what we're after.
Okay. So there was a question about clean water.
Mm-hmm.
tossed out at the debate in the cattle barn a couple weeks ago. You were there wearing your green shirts.
Oh, yeah. We had a group there with our green shirts on trying to get some attention. It's very hard to get attention in this state when it comes to things like water quality because there's so much interest, of course, in our $40 billion or whatever it is farm economy. And whenever you start talking about nitrogen or phosphorus or bacteria or neonicotinoids or whatever, you're really into dealing with very powerful forces who really don't want to talk about these issues. So it's hard, very hard to get on the radar.
Well, here's that clip with Branstad and Hatch.
The city of Toledo, Ohio, the residents there were unable to drink the water for a few days because of algae bloom in Lake Erie. Experts said it was largely caused by fertilizer runoff. The Des Moines Water Works manager says that ratepayers in Des Moines are paying higher water rates because of the extraordinary measures he has to take to treat the drinking water here. Governor, at what point is it required to have mandatory rules in regards to fertilizer use versus the current voluntary system?
Well, first of all, I'm very proud of the fact that we worked on a nutrient reduction strategy which has received national recognition for our leadership. And that has included Iowa State University with their knowledge and expertise in this area, the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, the Department of Natural Resources, and the Governor's Office. We just yesterday in this ring gave out 85 awards for environmental stewardship to farmers that are doing things to reduce pollution and making many changes to protect our water and soil.
So the voluntary is working, it's
working, and we need to continue to perfect and improve on it. We've increased funding by about 26% since I've been governor for these kind of projects. So I believe that's the right approach.
Senator Hatch.
The first thing that I want to say is that the problem of nitrates and phosphates in our water is not just a farmer's issue. It's all of us. Anybody, the golf courses and municipalities, the corporations, farmers are not the only ones. But the problem that we have is not so much in the reduction strategy plan, because that was required by the federal government. And it's a good plan. It's a good plan to start. And, you know, we want to talk about voluntary. If you don't fund it, then it's not going to be voluntary, and it ends up being nothing. And the governor vetoed $11.2 million of water quality money that would go to reduce the nitrates and the phosphates and the management of the very plan he said got national recognition. If you don't fund it, then you don't have a plan. And it's very telling that the legislature came up with the recommendations, bipartisan support. Even the Secretary of Agriculture, Bill Northy, was disappointed in the governor's veto of that.
All right. That was Branstad and Hatch debating for the governor's seat a couple weeks ago at the Iowa State Fair. So, Michael Delaney, what did your group, Citizens for Healthy Iowa, think of that exchange?
Well, the governor is very good. You know, he's a wonderful politician. He's a hard campaigner, and I think he's a good guy. In this arena, though, over the years, I really have been disappointed in him and the legislature in general. I don't really understand why he or his advisors or anybody would have wanted him to veto that $11 million because, you know, it worked that through the legislature, through all the committees. You had Republican and Democratic support, House and Senate support. Bill Northy can't say much, even though he is elected, but he was supportive of it. It was his project. The nutrient reduction strategy is all headed up by Bill Northy. And I've been in a lot of meetings with him, and I'm right there with him and his colleagues as they work on this strategy, and they're really trying. So I don't know where that came from, that veto. Now, Governor Branstad has said that since he's been governor, they've raised money, 26% or something. I don't know where he got that number. I'm around this stuff all the time. I have no idea what he's talking about. So maybe in the next debate, there'll be further questions. So we'll get a little more information about where he's coming from. It's probably a fiscal reason why he vetoed that, maybe how it was funded or something. But that has not come out clearly yet. The nutrient reduction strategy, I've been following this for years and years, and I'm watching it very closely. And the nutrient reduction strategy can work. Most of my friends, environmental friends, would say, no, it can't. But it can work. But it just means that a whole lot of farmers have to participate. Iowa State University has got all the data on what needs to be done to reduce nutrients. That's nitrogen and phosphorus, particularly, in our waters. The federal government's on the hook because downstream people are complaining. We have a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Everybody hears about the dead zone. Well, there are dead zones all over the world and all around the United States. It's because of nutrients coming out of our waterways with algae. And when it dies, it creates oxygen depletion and you get a dead zone.
No fish and shrimp?
The fish, you know, that's size of that. What is it this year? Size of Connecticut or something. It varies. But it's a huge body portion of the Gulf of Mexico where the shrimp fishermen can't catch the shrimp. They're still in the Gulf, but they're outside this area where the water is low in oxygen. So the things that are not mobile, they die on the bottom. So it's a big problem down there, and they say the problem is coming from upstream, and Iowa and Illinois are the biggest contributors because we have the most row crop, the most corn and bean production, and we put on a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus. So what Iowa State has come up with is a list of practices that farmers can employ that will reduce this loss. And so we're talking about buffers, we're talking about grassy waterways, we're talking about cover crops, we're talking about no-till, we're talking about the way that nitrogen's applied. It's better to apply it when the plants are ready to use it rather than in the fall and having it wash off in the fall and then wash off in the early spring. And then, you know, but all of that has its costs. If farmers simply go with what costs least and gives them the greatest profit, we're not going to get nitrogen and phosphorus reduction. So the state has come up with incentives. The legislature appropriated money, the IDOLs, and USDA, the federal government, has been giving out money for, you know, a long, long time to farmers to engage in practices that keep soil on the land and prevent nutrient loss. Well, now we need the incentives in order for farmers to participate in the practices. We'd like for all farmers to participate in a voluntary basis, but that's not happening without incentives. Oh, sorry, long answer.
That's okay. I mean, it's always good to give background on this nutrient reduction strategy because it's a complex issue. You know, we have other things going on like the Clean Water Act, which is a separate issue kind of. And so, you know, this multi-state effort to reduce the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico known as the nutrient reduction strategy is a central focus of this debate in our state. Michael, you've been so involved in water issues around the state for at least a decade. I am wondering what your connection is to water. Why do you get so deeply involved?
That's a good question. No, I pondered that. And I think it probably goes back to my father. My father loved to fish. He lived to fish. And I fished with him. And I love to fish. My son loves to fish. And it's about being out in nature and connecting very intimately with nature. When you're fishing, you're there on the water. And you, just by knowing about fish, knowing how to catch fish, you know what they eat. They know when they spawn. You know what they feed on. You know their cycles, the time of day, seasonality. I mean, just plugs you into nature in an intimate way that is similar to the pheasant hunters, the deer hunters, the turkey hunters. You have to understand nature if you're going to be successful at fishing or hunting. So those are the people that know what's going on out there. And when it comes to the water keepers out east or people who are very involved in water quality, it usually starts with the anglers. The people who fish, they notice it first when that water turns color, when the fish disappear, when the fish are belly up in the lake or the river. That they notice it first.
Where did you do this fishing in your youth?
Oh, well, I was I didn't know it at the time, but I was very fortunate because my father bought a lot and then built a cabin on Lake Pleasant in northeastern Indiana near Angola, and it is a natural glacial lake. So, spring-fed, a lot of sand, a lot of good vegetation, and very good fishing. That's why I bought the cottage there, was because of the quality of the fishing. So I just grew up with that and, you know, explored, you know, spent a lot of time on the water and catching things and making aquariums and all that sort of thing. So I was really engaged. Thanks to my older brothers, my father, I learned a lot at a young age and it was just a big part of my life. So I come out to Iowa. I was looking for water. I bought a farm or some land on the Raccoon River and, thoroughly have enjoyed the river.
Well, I promised I'd share more of my interview with Mary Skopek,
okay,
who you mentioned working with. And let's share what Mary had to tell me about water quality monitoring in the state of Iowa, beginning with the Iowater Volunteer Program.
Volunteer monitors and citizen science is becoming, I think, a really growing segment of monitoring in the country and in Iowa as well. We have the ability to use what we call field kits. So out at the stream site, you can actually test for nitrate, which is a drinking water concern, nitrite, which is a precursor to nitrate. We can look for phosphorus. We can look at the pH level of the water, and we can look at what the dissolved oxygen concentration of the water is, as well as chloride levels. So things like road salt will provide chloride to water as well as human sewage. In addition, we look at things like how transparent is the water. Is it clear? Is it cloudy? And then we look at habitat as well. So we're looking at streams and saying, you know, do we have good tree cover or canopy cover over the stream? Do we have rocky areas for the little bugs to hide under? Is it all just sediment? And then we also have E. coli bacteria testing as a more advanced program for volunteers who are interested. So you can actually culture these E. coli bacteria in your kitchen or in your garage or whatever. And then also look at biology. So we look at we call them benthic macroinvertebrates, which is just a fancy word of saying the little critters or insects that live in the bottom of the stream that feed the fish and the bigger creatures. And by looking at the diversity of those creatures, the sensitivity of those creatures to pollution, we can actually come up with a score for how is that stream doing overall. So if we find a lot of mayflies or caddisflies or stoneflies, that indicates a really high-quality stream. Whereas if we find nothing but, say, rat-tail maggots or leeches and don't find those higher-quality organisms, that tells us that that stream maybe is polluted through either sediment or nutrients or some other source.
I know that this volunteer-collected data is not official, and so how is that data used by DNR people? Do you pay much attention to that data since it's not certified, you know, real, quote-unquote, data?
And to understand the volunteer data, one of the things people have to understand is that Iowa has a credible data law, and the credible data law says that to be credible, it has to be collected by a qualified volunteer. And in fact, most of the Iowa water data would fall under that credible data law and could be used. It's more of an issue of the field kits don't necessarily provide the sensitivity that a laboratory analysis does. And so for us to make a call on whether or not you're meeting a water quality standard for oxygen, for example, or for nitrate for drinking water, we generally want a laboratory sample. So the volunteers can provide great levels of screening information. We're seeing an issue here that suggests low levels of oxygen, or we're seeing information that suggests that the biology isn't where it needs to be. And then the professionals can come in and do more extensive laboratory testing, or oftentimes we have partnered with the volunteers to get them the laboratory testing that they need. The other thing that oftentimes happens is we have a frequency requirement. So whether it's professional monitoring or volunteer monitoring, you have to collect ideally monthly, so 12 samples a year over 2 years. If volunteers have only sampled 6 or 7 times, that frequency requirement isn't going to be met. So we can give volunteers the tools to allow their data to be used for assessment purposes under the Clean Water Act. And we do see an awful lot of watershed projects assessing the performance of their watershed work to see whether or not they're making a difference in water quality using iWater volunteers, their expertise, and talking with the volunteers to understand whether or not things are getting better or not. So It's a little bit of a myth that the data cannot be used by the state. We've actually listed for impairment about two or three water bodies now using the volunteer collected data. So it can be, it can meet that requirement, but there's just certain things that you have to do for it to be used with, for the state for those purposes.
And if you see an issue with water quality in a particular area, what then actions does the DNR take?
It somewhat depends. So if it's a sediment coming off a farm field or if it's coming from golf courses or something, depending on the laws that we have in the state or federal laws, it may be just a matter of asking the producer or the landowner to be thinking about ways to put some conservation on the land to you know, reduce the amount of nutrients. Certainly, we've got a nutrient reduction strategy in the state of Iowa focused on getting more money into landowners' hands to reduce nutrients that are coming off the landscape. And that's not being done in a regulatory sense, but more we know that Iowa is nutrient-rich, and so we need to get some additional landscape measures working to reduce the amount of nutrients leaving the landscape. Cover crops, for example, seem to be something that's working very well to reduce nutrients. We've done some studies that have shown a 50% reduction of nutrients, specifically nitrate, coming off land with cover crops. So if that research continues to show that, that's something that might be moved into a more widespread use. Right now, I think we have 300,000 acres out of 25 million acres in cover crop. Certainly, there's a lot more room for improvement on the cover crop arena, as long as we're getting the kind of benefit that we think we would get out of cover crops.
You mentioned the nutrient reduction strategy, and this has been another thing I've heard quite a bit about, a concern that this nutrient reduction strategy demands a 45% reduction of nutrients from their current levels.
Mm-hmm.
And folks are wondering, do we have a baseline right now? And where is that being monitored and demonstrated? We know there's no timeline for this 45% reduction, but is there even a baseline?
And right now, I'd say the baseline has been coming from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources Ambient Stream Program. So we have about 76 water quality stations across the state of Iowa on relatively large streams, as well as the United States Geological Survey has data collection from large rivers as well, and the Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force has looked at that data, as well as other states' data, to come up with some of these reduction goals of 45%. The question you ask, I think, which is a more challenging one, is do we have baseline at the level that the implementation of the practices is going to happen? So on a very large watershed, it will take a long time to see that reduction occur. We need to drive the monitoring into smaller watersheds where we're focusing those dollars to pick that up. And there is some money that's going into that. I think there's probably more need to do more focused monitoring. And because we're talking about small watersheds, they respond very quickly. It requires a much more aggressive monitoring than has been done in the state in the past. So we really need to collect data before the practices happen in that sub-watershed to assess before and after what happened with the implementation of that best management practice, like a cover crop or a bioreactor. And oftentimes that's challenging because if we're looking for a voluntary landowner participation, we don't necessarily know 2 years beforehand who's going to participate and who's not going to.
So it's kind of a race. If you don't get the monitoring in place, then you won't capture the very bad before that the after will then, you know, help.
Yeah, and not to be the scientist too much, but it's really challenging because if we have a year like 2012, and 2012 was very dry, we didn't see movement of nutrients off the landscape much at all, then we move into 2013, it starts raining like crazy, we see very high levels of nitrate, for example, moving in the state post-drought. Depending on when you start your monitoring, if you started monitoring in late 2013 or early 2013, your interpretation of the results could be a little bit different based on that climate factor. Long-term data, we need extensive before and after implementation data. And oftentimes we just don't get that. So we're going to have to be creative in understanding ways of getting this information that we haven't been able to do in the past.
Well, I guess I'm curious, how serious is the Iowa DNR about this nutrient reduction strategy? Do they have a plan in place for gathering the before data.
And I think, you know, my bosses would say that's not necessarily the DNR's responsibility, that they see that as being more cooperation with other partners. So whether that's locally led efforts with folks that are more closely tied to the implementation, I don't think they see that as a DNR role to assess the effectiveness of the nutrient reduction strategy, that there are other players out there. So, for example, Iowa State has the Nutrient Reduction Center or the Nutrient Center. There's grant monies that are going out through that center that are focused on some of these questions about, are we seeing effective reduction in nutrients? And so at this point, DNR is not really in a leadership role for doing that assessment.
That's surprising. It sounds like, from what you're saying about the need for finer data, that we just basically need a lot more Iowa Water volunteers.
And I think Iowa Water volunteers have a really important role to play in that. One of the things that we are doing is getting these nitrate test strips that we have that we train regular volunteers how to use, and getting them in the hands of producers and other folks that are managing land so that they can go ahead and test what's coming out of their tile line or see what's coming off their particular field or creek so that they can have that more immediate impact assessment of what's going on in their landscape. And so we've been giving out these test strips and allowing them to just take a look at the information. They don't have to report it to us. They don't have to report it to anybody, but just use it in their own decision-making on a day-to-day basis or a month-to-month or year-to-year basis. So certainly the same kinds of tools and technology that the volunteers are using can be used at an individual producer level pretty effectively. But I agree. I think the more volunteers that get involved, the more information we'll be able to gather. One of the most expensive parts of water monitoring is just the people power and the people expense. So we are limited by the number of people we can hire to do monitoring. Volunteers bring a lot of energy and a lot of ability to collect data that would be very expensive, prohibitively expensive to collect otherwise.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, Mary. Thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Thank you for having me, Greta.
Was Mary Skopek of the Iowa DNR talking about water quality monitoring in Iowa. And I'm here, Greta Anderson, with Michael Delaney of the Raccoon River Watershed Association, Citizens for Healthy Iowa. This is a special Friday edition of Local Talk. We're calling Clean Water Radio. And we're going to turn to some news that we saw in Monday's paper about this clean water fight. But back to Mary's interview, I was a little surprised. I even said so, I guess, in the interview about her description of the DNR's role or lack of role in assessment of the nutrient reduction strategy.
Oh, well, yeah, that's been Mary's role, you know, heading up the Iowa Water Program and doing all this monitoring and getting all this information about the quality of our water. She's put together with Reach Leopold and Lynette and a network of volunteers that have been collecting all this information for years. That's why I was so concerned when it wasn't available for us to look at or to analyze. And now she's saying that her superiors don't really see themselves as having the responsibility of testing the water to determine whether the nutrient reduction strategy is actually working. And that's my most important point to make here is that, okay, we talked about the nutrient reduction strategy. Iowa State's got very good ideas about what can work to reduce the loss of nitrogen and phosphorus. And my question always in every meeting I'm with Bill Northey or Chuck Gipp or any of them is, okay, now, how are we going to know if it's working? And they have no answer. Because it is so political. You know, when you start talking about reducing nitrogen or phosphorus in a river, you're really getting into agribusiness's interest. If you monitor and really know what's coming down the river, people are going to be upset.
Well, Big Ag also pushed back this week with a news-making headline about the formation of a new group, the Iowa Ag Water Alliance. That was the Iowa Corn Growers, the Iowa Soybean Association, and the Iowa Pork Producers.
Mm-hmm.
You saw that headline on Monday?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I think that the governor is in a little bit of trouble, and I think that the IDALs, Department of Agriculture, and DNR are all in a little bit of trouble with the public because they have marched out the nutrient reduction strategy, and they're not measuring whether it's working or not, but they want the public to continue to send money to farmers as the feds have done for years and years. And now there's a veto of $11 million out of it. Okay, so where are we going from here? Well, okay, now we got a new strategy. The people who have fought every effort on my part and my friend's part to do anything about water quality are now going to clean up the rivers. We're talking about pork producers and the corn growers. Soybean Association's been helpful all along. And Sean McMahon has a huge reputation as being a fighter for the environment. So they've got a good guy standing up there.
This is the director of the Iowa Ag Water Alliance.
Yeah, right. Sean McMahon has been with the Nature Conservancy. He was a major player in the Iowa Water and Land Legacy effort. I mean, he's very sharp guy, and he knows the issues, and he is going to have a very prominent presence there. But my question to Sean and all of them will be, okay, let's see what kind of results you come up with as a result of your $600,000 of money from these commodity groups.
Okay. Well, I went to the group's website. They're, you know, brand new, so they don't have much up there, but they did list their mission, and there were three mission statements they declared. The first one was to develop metrics for the nutrient reduction strategy. The second one was to lobby against mandatory regulation, and the third was to raise more money for themselves. So, I guess they're upfront about the fact that they're going to be avoiding regulation.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What do they mean by metrics? That's my question. Because John Lawrence over at Iowa State University is the guy who's been given $3 million to assess whether the nutrient reduction strategy is working. If you ask him, as I have directly, are you measuring nitrogen and phosphorus in the water, he'll tell you no. Mm-hmm. All right. So how do you know?
Well, Michael, you drew my attention to Craig Cox. Let's get him in on the conversation. Craig Cox of the Environmental Working Group. This is a national organization specializing in research and advocacy in the areas of toxic chemicals, agricultural subsidies, public lands, and corporate accountability. As a national organization, it has a D.C. office, it has two offices in California, and then it has one here in Ames, where our next guest, Craig Cox, works as Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources. So we are very honored to have you on the show, Craig. You were quoted in these articles that came out about the formation of this new Iowa Ag Water Alliance. You said it was a baby step in comparison to the bold step that is needed. Would you like to expand on that comment?
Sure. You know, it is good news that at least three organizations that are leaders in the farm community in Iowa have stepped forward and acknowledged that there's a problem and that the way we farm has to change, and it's farmers' responsibility to do that. That's the good news piece. And I'm trying to keep an open mind on what this new alliance will produce. But my concern is it may be just more talk, and we've had a lot of that in Iowa and actually across the Midwest. That leads to very little action, and it's action that we need urgently now if we're going to turn this really poor, poor water quality situation in Iowa around in anything like a reasonable amount of time. Otherwise, otherwise it's going to be decades and decades and decades before Iowans see clean water, just like it's been decades since Iowa citizens have had to endure poor water quality. So that's my concern. I mean, we can talk about what those bold actions need to be from my point of view, but absent a dramatically picked up pace of improvement on Iowa's agricultural landscape, I think we're going to be waiting forever.
Well, let's go for it. What kind of bold actions do you think could?
Well, I think there's a sort of an interlocking series of things that need to be done. The first thing is we need some timelines. We need a due date when we're going to see cleaner water in Iowa, right? And we need that due date, for example, on when are we going to see us achieve the nutrient reduction goal set out in the nutrient reduction strategy. I mean, we have no due date. Absent a due date, there's no accountability. There's no way to measure progress. There's no way to decide that what we're doing isn't working. So that's the first thing we need. The second thing we need, which is going to be hard, is to acknowledge that reliance on a solely voluntary approach simply has not worked and will not work in the future. One definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Based on data that EWG has assembled and data that the Iowa Policy Project has assembled, we've spent well over $3.5 billion in Iowa since 1997 on voluntary conservation programs for farmers in the state, and we're still having this conversation about poor water quality and soil degradation and precipitous declines in wildlife habitat. So we just have to take a deep breath and admit that relying solely on farmers to volunteer simply hasn't worked. So my response to that is what we should do is look at some of these abusive practices that disproportionately cause a lot of trouble in our waterways. I don't want every farmer to have a nutrient management permit or to have that kind of regulatory oversight. But I do think there's a handful of practices that should not be accepted. Probably the best example is planting, your corn and beans right up to the stream edge. Right, the Iowa State Science Assessment tells us that if we had a 35-foot buffer between cropland and streams, we'd cut phosphorus load by 18%, which gets us almost two-thirds of the way to meeting the phosphorus reduction goal. Just that one thing. So why don't we have a mandatory setback of only 35 feet between cropland and streams? Minnesota has a mandatory 50-foot setback, and Minnesota agriculture is doing just fine. So there's other similar practices. This epidemic of gully erosion that we see in Iowa. Well, landowners should have their grassed waterways in place or their contour strips or other measures to heal up those gullies. Simple conservation practices that have been around for decades. There should be a core set of those practices that are just expected of landowners, with or without any cost share assistance from taxpayers.
Well, that's a very common sense, and yet in this political climate, a bold statement from you. The term abusive practices is, you know, catches the ear. And that mandatory setback sounds just like a good idea.
You know, I think actually if you had a group of farmers, not farm lobbyists or presidents of farm organizations, but if you actually assembled a group of farmers and had this conversation, some of which we had in other venues in Iowa, I think a lot of farmers would agree that some of these practices are just bad business. And they're certainly bad for agriculture's brand. And, you know, I don't think this idea would be completely off the table if we could really have a serious conversation with Iowa's farmers and landowners.
You know, that's really interesting. When I spoke with the Iowa Soybean Association, it was a commercial farmer. I heard him say that we know that there's going to be mandatory regulation at some point. It seems it's been simply a matter of kicking the can down the road as long as you can for these groups.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think it's really, really important that we take advantage of the opportunity to act now when we could construct a regulatory scheme, at least the kind of scheme that I'm suggesting, that would be far more workable for farmers, far more acceptable to farmers than what, you know, where we may end up if this problem just continues to get worse and worse and worse and there's no progress. Then we might end up with the kind of regulation that farmers fear. But we've got this golden opportunity now if we decide we're not going to stick with business as usual to do something way more creative that that we could all live with and see cleaner water.
Well, you mentioned that Minnesota has this 50-foot setback. Are there any other measures in other states that we can look at? The states to our north seem to be doing a much better job at keeping the water clean.
So, yes, there are. You know, almost all of the states, including Iowa, have some restrictions on winter application of manures, which can be a really destructive practice during snowmelt or heavy rains in the spring. I think Iowa could certainly tighten up those regulations from where they are today, but that's very common in the Midwest, those kind of restrictions. Iowa has a soil conservation law that authorizes our conservation districts to go out and inspect farms and notify landowners if there's excessive erosion on their fields. We should be doing that aggressively every spring. We should eliminate the provision in that law that farmers can't be required to heal up their fields unless there's cost share available. I don't think that's acceptable in this day and age. There are some states, not in the Midwest, but on the East Coast, that require access of livestock to streams to be managed, not necessarily fenced out, but hardened stream bottoms and stream banks where cattle can enter streams and dramatically reduce stream bank erosion. So there's lots of examples of states that have tried to look at these specific practices that cause a lot of damage, that don't affect a lot of farmers, but if they were healed up would make a big difference.
Yeah. Oh, I'd be given a cue here that I can ask you a question, Craig. Good to hear from you. You're so knowledgeable in this area, and you're so articulate. It's really great to have you as part of this conversation. I wanted to mention something that came from a farmer not long ago And it has to do with what you were saying about we have an opportunity now. If we sat down with real farmers, not, you know, representative of industrial ag corporations and so on, sat down with real farmers who have a history of land stewardship. I mean, we have farmers who have, for generations, their families have taken care of their land to make sure that it's profitable for their kids and their grandkids. They're interested in maintaining or, you know, organic material and soil tilth and porosity, all that stuff. This farmer is one of those. And he said that he would like to have buffer strips on his land, but he likes to let his cows out into his cornfield to clean up. And in order to have a buffer strip, according to current rules, he'd have to fence those cattle out of there 100% of the time. And he says he thinks it's unreasonable. Now, when he wants to let those cows out to clean up the corn, that they could go ahead and do that, and then you wander in and out of that buffer strip if they want to without really doing damage to the bank and to the river bottom. And to me, that sounds really reasonable. It seems to me that there are ways that, you know, that Iowans, you know, Idols, Jim Gillespie and company, you know, could work with farmers to come up with programs that would achieve the goals that we have of cleaner water, better water, without really hampering farmers' ability to produce the way they want to. It's just, I think there is a lot of room there in the middle to work out agreements with our farmers. And maybe it's just that Iowa should be able to manage some of the CRP or whatever it is, where our folks can deal more specifically with farmers' needs. What do you think?
Well, I think, so what am I trying to say? There is, interestingly enough, here in the Driftless area in Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, there is a lot of experimentation going on with using cattle, grazing riparian areas as as part of a project to restore those trout streams to health. And the results seem to be very promising. Trout Unlimited and the DNRs in those states are doing a great job, and we're learning a tremendous amount about how you can allow cattle to graze riparian areas without causing damage. So I think there's a an opportunity there. You know, I would like to again repeat, you know, that I don't think we're going to get there until there's some mandatory setback required. You know, a 35-foot mandatory buffer. If you expand that buffer to a, you know, ecologically sound buffer, then we should be willing to pay for that extra cost of putting that buffer in place. I agree with you. I think there's a lot of flexibility that could help us get there. The, you know, from an environmental point of view, the, you know, the two most dangerous words in conservation are done right, because we tend to get the done and we don't get the right. But I think if we, you know, if the DNR and the districts and other folks were committed to actually monitoring and helping farmers manage that, you know, I think that's a real opportunity.
Well, Craig, we've run out of time. We really appreciate having you on the show, and maybe we can do this again sometime.
That would be wonderful. It's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. A couple of announcements before we sign off here. There is a protest of the Brelsford Family Farm, Factory Farm at the east end of the High Trestle Trail Bridge on Sunday at 2 p.m. And I want to thank a listener for writing in about the issue of apathy. Keep the letters coming. We're glad you're out there listening. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. This has been a special Friday edition of Local Talk. We're calling Clean Water Radio. My guest for the hour has been Michael Delaney, founder of the Raccoon River Water Association, founder of Citizens for a Healthy Iowa, a fisherman and Iowa Water volunteer and participant in Project Aware, and really so much more. Thank you, Michael, for being here.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Thank you, Greta.
We also talk with Mary Skopek of the Iowa DNR and Craig Cox of Environmental Working Group. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Richard Morrison engineered the show. A podcast of this show will be posted later today on our website, khoifm.org. There you'll find links to the resources mentioned on the show. As always, your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
All of us at KHOI would like you to know that no waterways were degraded in the production of today's show. KHOI cares.